And those of you who have not yet become a current member of the KBOO Foundation can remedy that oversight. You can rectify that mistake at kboo.fm. You just click where it says donate today. And now, as promised, the incomparable Radio Zine continues.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng doing a different show this time. My guest is Timothy Egan, and he is a prize-winning author. And his latest book is The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero, which is kind of up my alley. We always like revolutionaries from anywhere. But welcome, Timothy.
Hi, Per. It's great to be with you here, and great to be talking about some of the eternal struggles of all people as epitomized by the Irish.
Well, you know, that was amazing. I thought, when I started reading this book, that first chapter, which sort of had Irish history going from the year 1100 mm-hmm. onward up to the birth of our hero, you know, I thought that was a great chapter, just summing up all this Irish history just in a few pages.
Well, you know, a lot of people, because we're approaching St. Patrick's Day, they have this kind of very surface view that the Irish are these jovial, you know, hard-drinking, corned beef, cabbage-eating, merry, colloquial folks, which they are. But the Irish story is a story of one country trying to completely erase the culture of another country, as you mm-hmm. mentioned. I mean, they mm-hmm. outlawed music. It was a crime to play the harp. They outlawed right. language. It was a crime to speak your native language of Gaelic. Mm-hmm. They took away their religion. They took away their land. Just everything they could to take away the dignity of these people for almost 800 years.
Mm-hmm. That was amazing. Some of the facts in this book that really astounded me. I mean, I've gone into quite a bit of Irish history, and that the Brits used to rip off the fingernails of harpers.
Right. So when you see a bottle of Guinness, you see the harp on the side
right.
there. When you look at the whenever there's any solemn Irish ceremony, you'll often see a harp in the picture. The reason is because it was a martyr's instrument. I mean, mm-hmm. they would rip off your finger. Most of the harpers, by the way, were blind. And so when Queen
O'Carolan, whose music we just heard a minute ago.
Really? So when Queen Elizabeth issued this edict in the 15th century, she said, hang the harpers wherever they are found. Mm-hmm. That was the actual edict. It was easy to round up because they were blind. So I tell people this, who often say, well, you know, why do the Irish cling to their Irish Catholicism? It's not because they love the Pope or the Vatican or anything like that. It's because the Brits tried to take it away.
That's right. It's a way of saying, hell with the Brits.
It's a way for a conquered people mm-hmm. to say, same with the harp. Mm-hmm. Same with hurling. You know, they outlawed the national sport, mm-hmm. hurling. Mm-hmm. So when the first colony was founded in Newfoundland, the first thing those Irish did was establish a hurling organization. Mm-hmm. So it was a mm-hmm. way for conquered people to say, screw you, we still have something. You can't take it all from us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one thing that really kind of struck me just reading this book is the cruelty of the British. You know, we think of the British as kind of noble imperialists and all that, which is
right.
a big lie.
Right.
And but the cruelty and this sort of phony high-mindedness that they used, it was galling. You know, it was just kind of
they had a real consider this. Now, the Brits did outlaw slavery before the United States did. Mm-hmm. I think it was 1837. But at the peak of the British Empire, when they were the mightiest empire on earth. One-fourth of the landmass of the globe was under the Union Jack of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. The most troublesome part of that entire one-fourth of the earth was barely 30 miles away.
Right.
They could not govern the Irish, and they had a huge blind spot. So this is an amazing fact. For almost 200 years, they had a bigger garrison of troops in Dublin, the Brits did, to keep the people in place, than they had in the subcontinent of India. Because they had this horrible blind spot. They had to do what all people do when they oppress their fellow human beings, is to make them less than human. They, you know, they were drunks and Celts and all these stereotypes you hear about them. But you're absolutely right. They were benign in many ways, but certainly not with the Irish.
Mm-hmm. Well, a little side note here. There's a very interesting book came out a while ago. A historian at Harvard, Carolyn Elkins, did a study of Kenya. Now we hear all this romantic stuff about the Brits in Kenya. Well, we don't know that they had concentration camps where 500,000 natives were imprisoned, and they did horrible tortures to people, you know. And
there was a few instances of English history we don't always read about.
Well, let's get on to our hero here. His name is spelled one way, but it's pronounced another way. We know the Irish throw in a lot of extra letters on you.
True.
Tell us about that.
I'll take the hit on that one. His name is Thomas Francis Marr, and he came of age. You know, what drew me to this story was you see the entire arc of Irish American history through this one man's life. So you see the famine, which was genocide. It's now recognized as one of the worst crimes of Europe. In fact, when Tony Blair apologized to the Irish in 1997 for the Great Famine, in which a million people died in 4 years' time, he said it was one of the great crimes of Europe. Ostensibly, it was because of the potato famine, but they let people starve. They were shipping food out of Ireland, grain, cereal, oats, barley, beef, pork. More beef was exported from Ireland to the British Empire than any other part of the British Empire, while a million people starved. So he comes of age during the famine, and I'll stop for a minute there. That radicalizes him.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is they really believed in free trade, didn't they?
Right.
Though millions were dying.
Absolute belief. So the Choctaw Indian Nation sent a shipload of corn to the starving Irish, and the Brits would not let it land in Dublin Harbor because they thought it would upset the free trade of, you know, natural food being bought and sold on the island. They said the Irish could have food if they were willing to pay for it. So they put them into these poorhouses, in which another almost half million either starved or got tired. And they had to, you know, do these make-work jobs. And, you know, the women would knit until their hands were all ragged. The men would move stones outside with a uniform. And then you'd come home in this crappy uniform and eat your bowl of soup. That was the condition under which. So my hero, Marr, gets radicalized by the crime of the famine. And he starts a revolution, tries to start a revolution, with six other people. It's known as the Young Ireland Uprising of 1848. And they're poets, they're philosophers, they're journalists, and, you know, has a sonnet ever beat a sword before? So you know what happens. It fails. And Thomas Marr, at the age of 25, is sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit.
Which was what? Well, how would Her Majesty dispose of the corpse?
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you asked that. You're the first person to ask me that. In an uprising 50 years earlier, in 1798, they threw the body parts into the streets of London and let the dogs come get them, and to let them know this is the fate of any Irish rebel. Now, remember, this is the educated class. This is the elite of Ireland while everyone else is starving. And they're all men and women because they believed in equality. The women had an equal claim. A lot of them were atheists, in fact, too. They were really ahead of their time for Ireland. They were all sentenced to be hanged, drawn, or banished. So on the eve of his execution, Her Gracious Majesty, Queen Victoria, commutes the sentence to lifetime banishment in Tasmania. So this is part two of the book, which is The Penal Colony.
Yeah, you know, just I know in Irish music, there's a lot of really sad songs about people being banished, the husband being banished, leaving his wife and children forever, which happened to some of the people in this book.
Yeah, they had a euphemism for it. It was called transportation. You could be sentenced to 7 years transportation or lifetime transportation. What it meant was, this is what it meant to Thomas Marr, they put him on a ship and he would never see Ireland again. never see his family again, mm-hmm. never see his friends again, never see his schoolboy chums that he'd walked the Liffey with, and sail halfway around the Earth's circumference to this continent that the Brits were trying to make into a penitentiary. 160,000 people were sent in chains to the foundation of Australia, and a fourth of them were Irish.
Hmm. So he was there for a few years, and he lived in this little cabin on a lake.
Right.
And, kind of tried to create a little Ireland up there.
It was a very funny thing, because these were Victorian gentlemen. Mm-hmm. And if they gave their Victorian code of honor, or their promise that they would not escape, the Lord Master of the island would let them live in a little district. Now, they weren't supposed to see their fellow convicts, but Marr found a way. There was a stream going next to the district of one of his comrades, so there was a little footbridge over the stream, and they arranged to have lunch there once a week in violation of their parole. Mm-hmm. But he built a cabin, and eventually he escaped. I won't tell you how, because I think it's one of many thrilling episodes as in a man who lived nine lives. But he escapes, and he comes to New York City in 1852.
Mm-hmm. What did he do there? I mean, that very interesting description of New York City in those days, especially this. I've heard about this neighborhood before, the Five Points area, kind of not too far from present-day Wall Street.
Exactly. So the Lower East Side, remember I said 1 million Irish died in the famine? Another 1.5 million left. So basically more than one in four people left the island. It was the first great massive movement of people from one side of the ocean to the other. Other groups would follow: the Norwegians, the Italians, the East Europeans, the Jews, Africans, of course, came in chains. But the Irish were the first real immigrant group. And a lot of them, the parents died on the way over, so the children would arrive as orphans. The vast majority of them never left more than a few blocks of the Lower East Side. So when Marr arrives, he sees this incredible squalor. I mean, these people are living in these tenement houses. They're rural people. They had no knowledge of an urban existence. Mm-hmm. They were pig farmers, and you know, so they're living in this horrible squalor in these Lower East Side. And there's basically a million of them, and it's all over. And he's heralded as their savior, the person who can give them dignity. Now, I want to bring
his reputation had traveled then.
I mean, exactly, and so the word had gotten out that Thomas Marr had escaped, and all the Irish American newspapers and New York Times gave him a big front page story. Irish hero arrives on shore, and you know, so he walks and he sees that some of the Irish who had been sentenced like him to be hanged and drawn are successful. Others are just living in squalor. But now here's the interesting thing to the present day. Because they were so disembodied, these people were rural people. They did fill the jails. They did fill the lunatic asylum, as they called it then. Mm-hmm. Words came into our vocabulary like paddy wagon and hooligan, both of which are not favorable terms, but they came out of the Irish. You substitute the words that Donald Trump used to describe Mexicans. They're rapists, they're criminals, they don't send their best people when he announced his candidacy. That is almost word for word what they said about the Irish. You just substitute the word Irish for Mexican. So a political party rose, the Know Nothing Party, in reaction to these waves of Irish coming ashore. And it's the first and only time in our history that a huge political party, because they became the second biggest party briefly, elected governors and state legislators, is formed for only one reason: opposition to a single ethnic group, the Irish. They pass laws to make it difficult for them to become citizens. They burn down some of their neighborhoods. There are actual pogroms in Philadelphia where they burn churches. They burn an Irish fire station. You have this huge backlash. And that's, unfortunately, what you're seeing in some respects now in the presidential campaign.
The Tea Party. And
exactly. And the lesson here is it's been a strain of our history. It comes and goes.
Well, of course, the immigration, a lot of this immigration that people are railing against is the result of the wars we've been fighting in Central America.
Well, exactly. You know? Yeah. And but I mean, it's unfortunate because we are this nation of immigrants. Less than 1% of us are Native Americans, you know, people who come from 10,000 years. And I saw a Pew survey poll the other day that said 35% of Americans view immigration unfavorably. I mean, come on, we're all from somewhere else. This is what's so crazy about this. Mm-hmm. So Marr finds his destiny in the immigrant masses who he wants to give some dignity to fight the Know Nothing Party. And how does he find his destiny? The Civil War.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is kind of a little sidelighted. you know, 10 years before the, or 20 years before the Civil War, there was the case of Los Patricios, these Irish draftees who switched sides and fought for Mexico.
That's a little known, that is a funny side bit. It's a little known thing, but they did switch sides.
That'd make an interesting book, too.
I thought about that. Right. Not for me, but I came upon that in my research. Yeah, so, I mean, and there was a real question at the dawn of the Civil War on which side the Irish would fight. Mm-hmm. Because when Frederick Douglass, the ex-slave and the gifted orator and writer, went to Ireland in the famine, he was amazed at how non-racist they were. He said, "I find myself treated as a man, not as a color." Mm-hmm. And he also said that the poor, starving peasants were, he said they were the only people I'd seen whose existence seemed to be as bad as the American slaves. But then he said when the Irish came to America and sort of got into this culture here, a lot of them viewed blacks unfavorably and became racist because they were afraid that these 4 million slaves, should they be freed, would take their lousy jobs. Mm-hmm. So the Irish were building the sewers of New York City. They were digging the canals in upstate New York. They were laying the brickwork. They were doing what would be the subway system. All these, you know, backbreaking, horrible jobs. They were the domestics for people's children. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm thinking about it now. It's basically what Latinos do now. And they were told that if you fight for the North and they free these slaves, what's going to happen to you? They're going to come up and take your jobs. So it's very courageous for Thomas Francis Marr, my hero, to some cases break with the Irish. And now he started the Irish Brigade in the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln smartly made him a general, which allowed a lot of the Irish to follow him. And this is how they became American. But it was courageous on his part. And this is where he finally found his destiny.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a good long section about the Civil War. I mean, the Fighting 69th. I remember growing up in New York hearing about the Fighting 69th, you know.
There's still songs about them. Mm-hmm. Some of the modern, you know, punk rock groups and stuff have written songs about the Fighting 69th. They're still quite iconic. So the 69th was a militia of New York City, for those folks who don't know about it. I'm glad you heard about them. Mm-hmm. And they were all Irish. But they were formally changed into the uppercase Irish Brigade during the Civil War. And the question was whether they could fight, because the people, you know, these Irish couldn't organize a parade without having fisticuffs. But, you know, and in between battles, they would sing their songs, they would have these big parties, they would have theater, they would stage steeplechase races, which the other generals thought was very odd, but a lot of them came around to it. But when it came time to put your life on the line, these people could fight. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they had the second highest casualty rate in the Civil War. So they ended up, as Marr himself came to conclude, they thought they would go, after they kicked ass in the South and beat the slaveholders, they would then sail across the Atlantic and liberate their homeland.
That was a sort of kind of quixotic notion.
It's funny. Somebody asked me that at an Irish-American gig last night, whether that was quixotic, using that very word. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually think it was, because in all, 160,000 Irish fought on the side of the Union. That's quite a size. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though the Brits had this huge garrison always in Ireland until they finally took their boot off them, that's a sizable amount if you could get even a fourth of that, because it would finally be an army. But what happened, Per, was they were so wiped out by Antietam, Gettysburg, Bull Run, all the iconic battles of the Civil War, where they were just mowed down. Mm-hmm. In one of the battles, they put a little sprig of green boxwood under their forage caps. Marr told them to do this so that when they found the bodies, they would know they were Irishmen. So they're absolutely wiped out. But here's the interesting thing in terms of what this means for history. Lincoln later declared the Emancipation Proclamation after Antietam, the bloodiest single day in American history, 23,000 casualties on one day. Irish casualties were among the worst. Marr recognized they weren't going to free Ireland, but their sacrifice had led to free African Americans. It was something that a lot of Irish didn't incorporate, but Marr ran with it and took it as his badge of honor.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had the one thing as in the book is the New York City draft riots.
That was the low point of the Irish mm-hmm. in this country. And you know, I won't excuse it, but I'll try to explain it. Mm-hmm. Back then, when we started the draft in 1863, the first ever draft in the United States, if you were a rich person or even mildly rich, you could get out of it. It cost you $200. If you put $200 down, no draft. Or you could bring a human being. So $200 or pay somebody to take your place. And the Irish didn't have $200 or they didn't have somebody to take their place. So they were being disproportionately drafted when they pulled the barrel through and they called the names. There was a Hanrahan, mm-hmm. O'Malley, you know, Henry, Egan. And they were coming through disproportionately Irish. They felt like, and then, you know, these widows would see, you know, the dead bodies coming in and all of this. They felt like they were taking too much of the brunt. Again, that does not excuse the draft riots. That sort of explains them. But they went after Marr, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would have killed him. His fellow Irish would have killed him in those draft riots had he been at home. He was away, and they slashed his portrait and burned it. I don't know if you remember that part in the book. They made a bonfire of the great Irish general mm-hmm. who's mm-hmm. a few years earlier was going to be their savior. Mm-hmm. So that was the low point.
Well, it's like, you know, the Irish, you know, I guess they came to this country hoping to return someday, which that attitude still persists, you know.
Right.
And, but somehow they got sort of swallowed up by America.
Yeah, all our good sides and all our bad things. I mean, the good and bad sentiment, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Now, that then leads to the final and most amazing chapter in Marr's life, and this is how I found out about the character in the book. So let me back up. About 7 years ago, I was at the Montana Capitol, Helena, Montana, and there's mm-hmm. this giant equestrian statue on the Capitol grounds, a man with his sword thrust into the air, and at the base of the pedestal are these fighting words from 1848 at Ireland. I go, God, who the hell is this guy? Mm-hmm. And the governor, it was Brian Schweitzer, a Democrat, says to me, "You call yourself an Irish American, and you don't know who Thomas Francis Marr is." And I didn't. And that sort of launched my journey. Marr ends up, after all these lives, famine, rebel, banished Tasmanian, you know, convict, immigrant hero, Civil War general, and number five, as the governor of a territory five times the size of Ireland, of Montana.
Yeah, and what was his life like there? I mean, he wasn't there very long before the end came.
Yeah, he came. Don't give away the end.
I won't.
It's one of the great mysteries mm-hmm. of Montana still.
Mm-hmm.
But he runs up against, you know, he always fought injustice. I mean, he really did. This man could not walk away from a fight. But he walks into the largest vigilante campaign in American history. They had lynched 37 people without trial by the time he showed up, and these were the right-thinking citizens.
That's a, you know, there's a little misconception. A lot of people, when they hear about vigilante justice, they think of kind of uncouth, lowly, low-class
exactly.
people. But these vigilantes, they represented the upper crust.
Yeah, they were the preachers. They were the mm-hmm. The lawyers, the prosecutor. They were. There's one difference though. They did not like the Irish. They were Protestant, and they mm-hmm. did not like Catholics. And mm-hmm. Marr was trying to bring all these Irish Catholics. They did come. In fact, my great-grandfather was one who came to Montana,
really?
To Butte, mm-hmm. Montana, where more Gaelic was spoken at one point than mm-hmm. any place outside of Dublin.
That's an interesting city.
Yeah, it is. Very interesting. And has a good St. Patrick's Day celebration as well. But so they came. The vigilantes were against them. The vigilantes were mostly Freemasons. And they did not like these Democrats. They did not like these Irish Catholics. And most of their victims were Democrats or Irish. They picked people off the street or they didn't like and accuse them of a petty crime and string them up. Marr pardoned one guy who had been arrested and was going to be executed without a trial. Remember, this is happening in a constitutional democracy.
Mm-hmm.
The American flag is flying over Montana territory. It's mm-hmm. not some distant place while they're hanging people formally without a trial. I mean, what bigger violation of our Constitution could you have? He, as the law, is saying you can't do this. So he pardons this guy. They hang him that night with Marr's pardon in his pocket. I have a picture of him in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then they drop off a note at Marr's house and says, the governor is next.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he's up against. I mean, mm-hmm. it's so. I mean, you could have written a book about any one of these episodes because mm-hmm. they're all so fascinating.
Oh, well, it was just... You really get into the history. You know, I was never a Civil War buff, but after reading those chapters on the Civil War, it was just...
It was industrial slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
right.
was.
And we've never had a higher casualty rate of any war. If you extrapolated the casualties mm-hmm. out right now, you'd have something like 20 million people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, too, that Marr, now he was what they call young Ireland, and like you said, these are poets. He was famous for being an orator. You know, he made lovely speeches and everything, and... But then later he became a Fenian. Tell us about the Fenians.
Yeah, let me just briefly mention the orator part, though. One of his compatriots in Ireland said listening to him was like listening to sonorous music. Mm-hmm. He could hold a crowd rapt for an hour, and he spoke. He became known as the Young Tribune. I mean, when he's barely 22, 23 years old, he's starting to draw these big crowds. The guy had the gift of gab. And during the height of the uprising, he speaks to 50,000 people from a mountaintop trying to rouse these starving peasants. That's my chapter is called Pitchfork Paddies, because they're starving people. They don't have any guns. He's trying to rouse them against the British. And he holds them, you know, spellbound for an hour. Comes to New York, and everywhere he speaks, there's sellout crowds. And there are mar clubs that spring up. There's a polka done in his honor. So the man certainly could speak. The Irish nationalism post-Civil War takes the form of the Fenian movement. And I'm glad you brought that up. Credit to you for knowing your history. The Fenians did briefly...
Sinn Féin is... I think they just scored very well in the recent Irish election.
They did score very well, right.
Sinn Féin, by the way, means ourselves alone, I believe.
Right. Very good. And, so they invade Canada, actually, the Fenians. It's a not well thought out.
Another quixotic.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean, look... Canada then was called British North America.
Right.
And their idea was that if we could hold one city hostage, we would use it as leverage to get the Brits the hell out of Ireland.
It could work.
Yeah, it could work, but it didn't. It failed miserably. Mar himself took the Fenian Pledge. And so while he was governor of Montana, he was a Fenian. And the Fenian Pledge said simply this, I will fight to my death to liberate my country from England. That's all it said. It didn't say how you would do it. It just said that. And the Brits were afraid that they were going to launch an attack from Montana. So there's long bit. You could go to Montana today and go into a bar or go into a church or go into some place in between and find yourself an Irish American and ask him about Mar's death. And one of the persistent lines of speculation is that the Brits killed him because, A, he was a fugitive. Of the British Empire. He had a price on his head. Remember, he'd escaped from them. Even though he was a governor and Civil War general, he still was a convict with a price on his head. And B, they were afraid because he has now got a state or his territory, soon to be a state, and he's got all these followers living there, that they were going to launch a Fenian assault from Montana into Canadian, what did they call it? British North America, right? So there's a persistent strain that of speculation.
Well, actually, when in real time, the Fenians rose up right out of Ireland, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, well, this is the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, and I think in some ways the people there were very much like young Ireland. You know, they were poets and artists and whatever, and. Except for James Connolly, I guess.
You know, I have to compliment you. For a non-Irishman, you actually really know your Irish history.
Well, it's fascinating.
I'm very impressed. But I think I am hoping that in this book you'll see some universal themes that sure, we Irish love to revel in our stories of, you know, finally throwing off the Brits, et cetera, and how we lived in those years of trying to deculture us. But I think there's some universal themes here. And also the Easter Rising. We have this year is the 100th anniversary of the 1916 rebellion, which failed initially, but then the Brits shot all the leaders and made martyrs of them. And that led to a general uprising, which eventually led to an Irish Free State. They had revived Mar's words during the 1916 uprising. Mm. One of his slogans was a simple slogan, Ireland for the Irish. Also, the national flag of Ireland, on one side.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, the green on one side, the orange on the other, representing the two opposing sides, Protestant orange, Catholic green, and the unifying white in the middle. Entirely Mar's creation. He gave Ireland its flag. He was walking in Paris with some other young islanders after one of the Parisian uprisings and was struck by the tricolor of the French and brought home this idea. Which this day, if you go to Mar's home, and I it was so much fun researching this book. I went to his house and I went to his jail cell. You know, in Ireland, jail cells are national shrines and tourist destinations. I don't know if you've ever been in Kilmainham Jail in Dublin.
I know. Heard about it.
Yeah, they say once you've been there and spent some time in there, if you don't hate England after coming out, you don't have a heart. So I sat in Mar's cell while he was waiting his execution.
Well, it's very interesting that for the young Ireland people, you know, America was an inspiration, but Is it still an inspiration for revolutionaries, or have we kind of gone off track?
Well, you know, it's still an inspiration for hope. I mean, Ireland had a horrible, we think we had it bad during the last recession. They just got clobbered. Unemployment was in excess of 20%. Houses fell into the bankers. And then there was a sort of, this last election show, there was sort of a rebellion against the elite class for getting theirs, while water rates went up for the people, et cetera. And I would say, as far as an inspiration, yeah, I mean, they look to, they admire Thomas Jefferson. They admire, you know, JFK, John F. Kennedy was a great, great president. I mean, I call him the last prince of Ireland. In fact, a few months before Kennedy was assassinated, at about Mars' same age, he came back to Ireland, and he came with the Irish flag, and he came with Thomas Mars' words. And so, yeah, they still look to us. I mean, they think we're in going through some period of insanity right now, as all of Europe does with Donald Trump, but that's another question.
Oh, well, we could talk for a long time here. You're going to be at Powell's tonight, is that right?
Yes, I hope everyone comes out to Powell's and sees us and visits with us tonight. I think it's 7:30 at Powell's.
Better get there early, 7:30. If I go to one of these, I usually get there around 7 because it fills up pretty fast sometimes.
Yeah.
And this is the one downtown on 10th and Burnside.
Correct, yes.
So that's tonight at 7:30. You can see and hear Timothy Egan talk all about his book. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Paris, a wonderful interview. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a lot of fun. This is sort of dear to my heart. It really is. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Now stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 12 o'clock. It's the noontime hour. And we all know that KBOO is already an integral part of your life, being that it's a vital piece of the cultural fabric of the Pacific Northwest. And that's just one reason why I'm going to ask you to consider remembering the KBOO Foundation in your charitable planned giving, along with your family members and friends. Planned gifts can also provide valuable tax benefits for you and your loved ones.